not really. An occasional notification of some great event that you don't want to miss. So the Shaping San Francisco talks are part of a larger effort that we're involved in which we make history a creative act in the present, things that we do together to really understand how the world got to be the way it is. And we are coming out with our newest version of Shaping San Francisco. It's version 5. It's a wiki version, which means that if you're familiar with Wikipedia, it means it's a version that all of you can actually write your own versions of history into. And it's going to make a really interesting process of sort of, you know, everybody's talking all these days about Facebook and social networking software and all that. And we're very excited about having a project that takes advantage of our collective capabilities and our shared wisdom about the world we're in and our individual stories and creates a space where that can finally find its voice and find each other in that space. So keep your eyes on shapingsf.org for the link to the new wiki, which will open up to the public in just a couple of weeks. Tonight we have one of our ongoing series under the rubric of Nature in the City, and Peter Brastow will come up in half a second and say some words about Nature in the City before we get started. But the panel obviously is on the topic of Candlestick Point State Park for the People, and we have with us tonight Claude Everhart from Friends of Candlestick and Patrick Rump from Literacy for Environmental Justice and Alan Hopkins from the Golden Gate Audubon Society. I believe it's Golden Gate, right? Yeah, got that right. And so before they get started, though, let me bring up Peter Brastow to say a few words about Nature in the City and our ongoing collaborative efforts to alter the ecological reality that we live with here in urban life in San Francisco.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Hi, everybody. Welcome. My name is Peter Brastow. I'm founding director of Nature in the City, and I think I know almost everybody in the room considering our small turnout tonight, thanks to Mr. Obama's infomercial that's on in 16 minutes. So, but welcome, welcome. And Nature in the City is an organization that I founded in 2005, and we're dedicated to the restoration of San Francisco's nature and biodiversity. Our vision is for literally a San Francisco restored with the natural areas and wildlife habitats and corridors and creating a future ecological wonderland where we are way more in touch with nature than we have been for many hundreds or perhaps thousands of years right here in the city where we live, in our own backyard. And we do all kinds of stuff trying to reach that overall mission and our goals. You may have heard of McLaren Park Earth Day and the Green Hare Street Corridor, which is a project for which we had a panel discussion last night in Golden Gate Park. That was really, really fun. So we're trying to restore a little corridor for the Green Hare Street Butterfly over in the western part of the Sunset District. Lots of other exciting projects, and I won't talk about them all right now. You can go to natureinthecity.org to find out a lot more. And you can also sign up for our email newsletter there. Become a member if you like, which would be terrific. We're a small organization trying to grow and become huge institutional behemoth stuff. So if you become a member, we'll send you a map in the mail. This is our wonderful second edition Nature in the City map, and we have a few other benefits, and depending on which level you rise to in your contribution. And I've got a bunch here, so please take one with you. We would love a donation for the map if you can spare it. We spent a lot of sweat equity in getting this beautiful product together. I also brought some leftovers from the Save Candlestick Point campaign, so take those away so I don't have them in my office anymore. So, and then just a couple of Nature in the City postcards to remind you to look at the website. And a little postcard of the map itself, which you can send off to somebody and get them to become a member. And you can find out more about the GGNRA Big Year project, which we're principal sponsor of, at ggnrabigyear.org. This is a sample of that really exciting project to see and save the GGNRA's 33 federally listed species. And that's about it. I got some brochures here, and one particularly, these are from the Rec and Park Department Natural Areas Program. They have a whole series of natural areas brochures, and I brought the one about Bayview Hill because of its proximity to Candlestick Point, which we decided would be a really great topic, and we're surprised that we don't have 100 people here. However, we think we know the reasons why. And among many other very important conservation and restoration problems in the city, Candlestick Point is a wonderful natural resource and a state park, the only one in San Francisco. So we thought that it deserved to be talked about all by itself. And I'm very happy to have our panelists with us tonight. There's a lot going on down there. And this group of three is going to try and shed light on all that. So I don't know who's going first, but take it away. Thanks, everybody.
school people from around the state. Hello? Oh, that sounds different. Hello, hello. So we were put a coalition of people together from throughout the state and convinced their a new assemblyman for our area, Art Agnos, to carry a bill as his first bill as a legislator, AB1 in 1977, to require that the state of California build a state park at Candlestick. After the victory of getting that bill passed and signed into law, then our Friends of Candlestick group, along with the State Parks and Recreation Department, launched an effort to plan the park, and we literally had over 200 meetings all around the state, because it being a state park, we wanted to listen to people not only from the southeast portion of San Francisco, but the Bay Area region and throughout the state as to what this park ought to be. And as you can tell out there, it's not a normal park that you see in the city. There are no tennis courts out there. There are no basketball courts. There are no baseball diamonds. That was a conscious plan by residents who participated in those planning meetings, who wanted this to really be a state park experience and to provide primarily young people, but people of all ages in that part of the city, an opportunity to experience the environment in ways that inner city neighborhoods don't often get to experience the environment. And that park was developed initially as a fishing pier and a picnic area, and it went on and expanded into literally an environmental interpretive center, into a community garden, and to a host of other things. But it really pointed out to a lot of people that if you really work with people and give them the time and the opportunity to really express themselves about the kinds of recreational and educational environments they'd like to have, people have sense to know that they didn't want to transform this beautiful shoreline into, you know, some, you know, manicured city park, but rather that we ought to enhance the natural resources that are out there. Now, the park is only 1/4 finished. There's a general development plan that's been on the shelf for about 20 years. And frankly, after Art left the legislature, and while we had other legislators who've been supportive of the park, we really haven't had anyone who's taken the park on as a mission like he did. And therefore, we have not gotten the kind of funding for Candlestick that we got in its early days. So we only have really built 1/4 of it. But even at 1/4, you can see what a valuable resource it is. We actually reclaimed from a junkyard a beautiful shoreline park. There are incredible environmental resources out there. There's windsurfing, there's fishing, there's picnicking, there's jogging, there's bike riding, all things that people can't do in most of our city parks. It's an entirely new experience. And I don't know what your reaction was the first time you came out there, but usually when people come out there for the first time, the exclamation is, wow, we didn't know this was here. It's one of the least publicized resources in the city, yet I believe it's frankly one of the most beautiful. And we'll talk as we go along about the need to protect the park. But fundamentally, Candlestick Point State Recreation Area is something that was born from people, that people lobbied and pushed and worked and fought to preserve the environment And we don't have a lot of examples of that kind of preservation, particularly coming from inner cities. Thank you.
Okay, let's see if I know how to see if I can do this. Master the technology. Uh-oh. Did it do something? Okay. There we go. Okay. I've been going out to Candlestick for longer than I can remember. As a bird nut, basically it was pretty much the only place in San Francisco that I could see a lot of species. And I started going out there before the park was really developed. Before there were any trees, before there were any lawns, big part of it was still looked like just a raw landfill. So it was really exciting to see the changes happen. And I thought what I would do is lead you through a little tour of the park from a bird watcher, naturalist point of view. So this is actually the extreme sort of southwestern part of the park, and I'm going to take you through. So this, the little colored section you see there is part of actually a sculpture by Patricia Johansson called Endangered Garden. And this was actually the cause of me becoming formally involved with Golden Gate Audubon Society. I was, my background is in art, and she was proposing this piece, and the board of directors of the Audubon Society didn't know anything about art, and she wanted to take the piece into the mudflats, and they were kind of concerned about that, and so they asked for my sort of opinion on it, and it was decided that I probably shouldn't go out into the mudflats because they're valuable habitat for a lot of birds, like this long-billed curlew. Which is a pretty common bird out there. Population is, the world population is 20,000 birds, which is not a lot. So this is just one of the birds that I used to go out there. Actually, I lead field trips out there a couple of times a year. I have one trip that's called a bird blitz that we try to see as many species as possible. And this is one of the places that we have to go to look for the long-billed curlew and a lot of other species. And then I've got another field trip that I lead out there every year. And it's for Santa Clara Audubon, and people come all the way up from Santa Clara to go birding at Candlestick, which I think is pretty exciting. So this is the site plan for Patricia's piece, and she finally decided that it shouldn't go out into the middle of the mudflats. But the idea was that you could see, this is based on a San Francisco garter snake, and the idea was that you could see it from the airplane as the planes were flying over from SFO. And here is another little part of the piece installed. And it's really a wonderful way to visit the park. You've got a lot of different habitats and this sort of meandering paths. And one of the nice things is you can get right close to the water there. And among the critters you can see there, you know, brown pelicans, common loons, which with a little crab. These are both birds. The pelican, of course, was on the verge of extinction for a while, and the common loon is not doing particularly well, so we want to protect their habitat. In the drier areas of the park, we can find some species that aren't found elsewhere in San Francisco or in very few places. And it's a good place to look for the California ground squirrel. And I found out last night that the pygmy blue butterfly is there, which I didn't know about. And there's some interesting terrestrial habitat restoration / art going on there that's sort of associated with the San Francisco garter snake sculpture there. At the south end of the park there, which is, it's getting very interesting, and I would have taken a picture of it, but it's the end of summer, it looks very dry and not very pleasing, but it's really quite a nice sight, and it's getting pretty exciting. Another thing that I just thought about that I meant to tell you about was that with the Port of San Francisco and Golden Gate Audubon Society, we've produced a little bird book called The Birds of 100 Birds of Heron's Head. And you can get, I think you could probably get that free from the port. And it focuses on Heron's Head Park, which is a park that's on the other side of Hunter's Point, but it's basically, it covers the entire coast. And I don't know, can you get it through Ledge, or does Ledge
have some, but I think there's a very few copies left.
Okay, well, I think
I can, if people are interested, I could contact the port and see if they have more.
Yeah, the port will have more, and I'm sure since this will cause a huge rush, the port will probably have enough to support it. So the California ground squirrel is there in good numbers. If you're lucky, you'll still see jackrabbits out there. I saw some the other day. And when there are rabbits and ground squirrels, there are birds of prey like this red-tailed hawk, and kind of keep the ecosystem in check. So you've got a predator and prey base out there. Pretty exciting. And migratory hawks like this merlin. So this merlin may have nested up in Alaska. This bird was here just the other day. Yeah. So my background in art, I found that this is a new gate by David Ireland, which was installed, I think, in 1986. And David Ireland's actually a very well-known artist, and this is out of his book. Let's see, The Way Things Are, The Art of David Ireland. Anyway, this was installed, and one of the things that's fascinating for me is that this actually provides habitat. And so one of the places I used to like to roam around was, I still roam around, is this place, although it's become greatly degraded recently, and we call this Rock City. And there are these, all this, it's basically big chunks of concrete that were all piled up long, long time ago. And it's kind of dangerous to walk through, but if you're really lucky, you can see birds like this burrowing owl. The burrowing owl is a bird that should be listed, but it's not, because it likes nice flat places that are really good to put shopping malls and housing developments on top of. So I don't know that there's been one in the last couple of years, but they show up there pretty periodically. Actually, Golden Gate Audubon produced a plan to kind of restore or hopefully save the owl population there, and it never happened because the owl disappeared before we could do anything with it. But I think maybe Patrick will talk more about this area. So this is what the new gate looks like now, and it's sort of sad to see it in sort of decline. One of the other exciting things is that there's all this sort of informal sculpture out there. So when I'm out there bird watching, all of a sudden I'll come across something like this that's obviously somebody's creation. And unlike the stuff that's out on the mudflat, this is very kind of personal because it's in a place it's very secluded. And it depends on your taste in art, but I really enjoy these little pieces. And I don't know who's doing them, and they just sort of spring up around. And this is actually after you've walked through that gate, and this is kind of a nice dry spot that has a lot of nice animals. So, it's one of the nice spots for a western fence lizard in the city, because it's dry and warm, unlike the western part of the city that's cold and wet all the time, not very good for lizards. Okay, this is Yosemite Slough and South Basin, which is one of the richest areas, at least for me. This is the finger of water that's going off to the left. Is Yosemite Slough, and that's a very nice tidal area. And on the right-hand side, the larger body of water is South Basin, and that's a great spot. And if you look closely, you'll see two little rocks out there, and that's called Double Rock. And Golden Gate Audubon and some other agencies, I don't know if was Ledge involved in this? did a number of surveys of all the wildlife in here, and we found it to be a very rich area. And so these are mostly scop, but if you look really carefully, you know, sometimes you'll find birds like this long-tailed duck, which is a sort of whitish duck with a black cheeks in the middle. Double Rock is a really rich little area, other than the fact that it's where Humphrey the humpbacked whale ended up. It's got nesting birds there, and a lot of birds use it as a high tide roost. This is a black oyster catcher, and the world population of black oyster catcher is 9,000, and we believe that they nest on Double Rock, although we haven't caught them at it yet. They're probably nesting on the side that you have to look at from the Hunters Point shipyard. And once again, all these little rocky outcroppings are really important as upland roosts for all these wintering shorebirds. San Francisco Bay is one of the most important stopovers for migratory shorebirds and ducks, as some of them will go as far as Tierra del Fuego. And, you know, this looks blighted, and it is blighted, but if you look really carefully among the rocks and on the mudflats there, you'll see that there are things like the oyster catcher, the long-billed curlew, black-bellied plover, greater yellow legs. All these migratory birds are coming into these to the mudflats. And here's some western sandpipers that are coming into the exposed mudflats. So it's really a rich area for the birds and for the people who like to look at the birds. My kids in parks class. These are kids from Visitation Valley Middle School, the sixth graders, and the first class we do is we take them up to a high spot in McLaren Park and do what we call ecology mapping. And we ask them to, we give them a little blank page with a silhouette of San Francisco in it, and we have them fill out the map. And we find that the kids look down there and they don't know what that body of water is down there. They say, oh, is that the ocean? Is that a lake? You know, they've never been there. They don't have any experience with it. So I think this is one of the reasons for me that, you know, bird watchers are nice, but, you know, we can go to, you know, the Palo Alto Bay Lands or some really fancy spot if you're not a county lister. But not everybody can do that or will have the opportunity or know to have the opportunity to do that. So these are some kids. They're not kids in my class. I just happened to find them. You know, they were collecting crabs in the park one day, and they were having a great time. And this is, to me, this is as important as having bird watchers come and watch birds. You know, because if we don't educate the kids about what our parks or what wildlife is about and what nature is about, if they don't have a firsthand experience, we're not going to save it. You know, if we only have Yosemites and Big Surs and Point Reyes, it's not going to be enough to keep the resource healthy. So that's my last slide, and I'll turn it over to Patrick. Thanks.
Maybe you guys can trade seats, Alan and Patrick, so that he can get to the slideshow, and I'll help you get yours running there in a moment.
Claude, you know, what I might do is, since Claude has to leave.
Yeah, Claude has to leave, right.
If we want to open up questions to him.
Sure, yeah. Do anybody want to have any questions about the history of the park or anything else that Claude addressed before he has to go? I'm also going to pass the hat. This is the typical time of the night where we go and we look at this vast audience and we think, we could raise $15,000 tonight. Okay, so each of you put in $1,000 and we'll be very happy tonight. You know, anything you can do, we always like to say, well, you've gone and seen a really terrible movie lately for $10, so this is way more interesting than that. I'm sure you'll agree. But do what you can. It's just how we help defray the cost of having lovely open discussions like this. But give Claude a question or two, if you can.
Yes. You know, we had not been for some time. We just kind of pooped out, frankly. But this year, when the governor proposed to close state parks, including Candlestick, we kind of pulled back together, and working with these guys, we built a new coalition. So after the first of the year, we've agreed that we're going to kind of put Friends of Candlestick back together. So if you're interested at all, please sign in over at the table, and we'll put you on our mailing list, and it would be great, because as Patrick will describe, going forward, we've got some threats to the park, that so it's going to be real important that we organize in 2009 for the park. Yeah, well, we're gearing up for them. Over here. Well, actually, there was a general development plan that had gone through all of the public hearings and things that I mentioned. They would probably need to be amended now and updated, but we had planned on, for example, where the gate is, there was going to be a wind harp developed and an amphitheater, and there were a whole bunch of new additional resources. In fact, we planned what we called at that time an ecology cultural center to be built out there, so we'd have a place that people could come to learn about the resource. So none of that really expensive stuff was ever really done.
Claude, I want to... Oh, good. Go ahead.
I was curious if there was some kind of land swap that might be happening with the development.
I think Patrick will talk about that a little more. That's one of the things that's being considered. Let me just give you my commercial if I can before I leave. We worked really hard to get the state to buy the land that's there now, owned by the state. Your bond money paid for that, with the intent that a major amount of the shoreline would be dedicated to permanent open space and developed as a state park. Now we have a new development proposal out at Candlestick. I'm not going to give you my personal opinion about that development proposal, other than to say I believe it's utmost importance that we preserve the integrity of the park, and that land swaps not be used to all of a sudden make this into some kind of quasi-city park to satisfy some developers' open space requirement. I really am concerned about the pressure that will be there to develop the shoreline areas and then to move our park and things inland, and to say that somehow that was a swap. You know, it's not.
Yeah, and I could just chime in there and say that that's definitely Nature in the City's position too. You know, the park is as it is now, has a boundary, and we should be expanding the boundary. We shouldn't be decreasing it. And so in whatever form the development takes, you know, we want to see open space and restoration and natural resource preservation increased, and by no means for the Candlestick State Park boundary to be taken back in any direction. And we're working with lots of other folks to, you know, see that happens in the right way. I wanted to ask a quick question before you go as well, Claude. In terms of the land itself there, I get the impression from your talk and Alan's, and maybe Alan can answer this, that there was just a lot of dumping there over the decades that probably filled in, you know, some of the shoreline. Was there anything even more organized and intentional, such as what happened at Heron's Head when they were, you know, built a huge dump there to make a bridge, but it didn't happen? Or is it all just sort of incremental over the years?
Well, that entire area, you know, I don't know a lot about that history, but you folks can probably recall that the very interesting history of building the stadium, the Harney family that had dumped a lot of things in the bay. And in fact, there are people who actually own lots, you know, a quarter of a mile out in the bay, because that originally was intended to be filled all the way out there. And at some point, the people in the city got smart enough to say, we're not going to fill in the bay to Oakland, and we put a stop to it. And the state actually had to buy some of the shoreline underwater lots from people, and actually to build the park. It's kind of funny because the state figured out they only needed to buy the actual shoreline underwater lots. They didn't have to buy the ones that were further out in the water. Okay? And so there are people out there now who are very upset, who pay property taxes to the city and own these underwater lots that they will never get to develop. So the nefarious purpose, frankly, of the landfill was to move the shoreline out and ultimately to develop it. And as you know, one of the greatest boondoggles was they built Candlestick on that filled land. And, you know, we can go back and watch Giants 49er games back in the 60s and see that the field down there was sinking because it's all filled land. So. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You cannot, if it rains, you can just see the parking lots out there become flooded because it's all essentially under the tide line.
I'm just going to chime in with the Charles Harney story is told pretty well by Burton Wolf in an expose he wrote in 1973, which we have put it into Shaping San Francisco. So anybody who wants to dig up the deeper story of the corruption in the city when George Christopher was mayor and the whole luring of the Giants to the West Coast with the promise of this new stadium and yada yada. And the Harney family actually owned the water lots around Bayview Hill, and then they began doing the landfill. And then they got the rights to build the stadium, the exclusive rights to build the stadium. So there's all this corruption going on in the whole deal from start to finish. But anyway, I wanted to go back. I love that. I'm glad you brought that thing up, too, about people owning lots out there, because you can see these maps from the teens and 20s, actually, these Rand McNally maps that show streets in San Francisco extending way out into the bay. And I think it was actually the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, the Petras-McAteer Act of 65, that really stopped the filling, because I think they would have just kept going. Every single jurisdiction around the bay felt, well, we better hurry up and fill so we have more real estate and more tax dollars coming in, et cetera. And then, of course, Brisbane Lagoon, right around the corner from Bayview Hill, it was the San Francisco garbage dump for 45 years. And one of the great ironies of local ecological history was it was the stench of San Francisco's garbage that saved San Bruno Mountain from development. Nobody really wanted to live there because it smelled so bad. And so now we have this incredible ecological treasure. I have one last question for you before you leave, which is maybe somebody else has even a further one, but I'm interested if in that early discussion that you guys were involved in the community, both in the southeast part of San Francisco, but even more broadly, how did the concept of nature play in those discussions? Because obviously you're talking about landfill and rubble and then turning it into something beautiful and natural. I mean, the bay remains a natural phenomenon regardless of how badly we've treated it. But typically in these kinds of discussions, people sort of invoke this notion of nature as this thing that's different than what humans are doing. And I love the story of Candlestick Point precisely because it's completely a story of humans deciding to make nature a beautiful thing as part of our lives and making very specific decisions about it. So I wonder if you could just speak a little bit to that in the history of the story.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting that you had people who remembered what the shoreline was like before they started filling it in. And then you had people who really had a vision that for all that junk out there, it was land that could be reclaimed. I mean, that's why there's so much artwork and other things out there. And we've always welcomed creative people to come out there. And, you know, we've understood it's a junkyard, okay? So we can do things that you necessarily wouldn't be able to do in other places. But weirdly enough, people always wanted to make sure that what was being done out there, whether it was with the artwork or the rubble piles and all those kinds of things, that it enhanced the natural beauty and the natural benefits out there. The other thing is, again, you had all these city folk. I mean, you can look at me and tell this is not a park body, right? I'm not your hiker Yosemite type of guy, right? And most of the people who were part of this weren't. But people who live in cities still appreciate nature. And we realized what a valuable resource the Bay and Candlestick could be. And people never wavered from that. And it was really interesting, and that's why the planning process was so important, because as we went through that planning process, we had some amazing landscape architects from the State Parks Department that kind of worked with people. And as it evolved, all these really good things came out of it. And the lesson, my last little pitch would be, as they're planning all this fancy development out there, someone mentioned they went to a meeting with the city to talk about the thing, and the city people talked for 2 hours rather than letting the people talk. We would have a much better development out there if they'd let the community talk, if they'd really give the community time to really get a sense of what that place is about and what it can become. And Candlestick is the example that if you let people to their own devices, people really do have sense. And that really is kind of the fundamentals of what democracy ought to be about. And instead of us always having to react to other people's visions for us, Candlestick was one place where people were able to express their own vision for their own park and their own neighborhood, and that's what ultimately came about. So with that, thank you very, very much, and I hope everyone will be part of Friends one day, and I hate to walk out on my friend Patrick's speech, but he understands.
Thank you, Claude. That was great. Next, we have Patrick Rum from Literacy for Environmental Justice.
That's a tough one to follow up. So I'm Patrick Rum. I work for Literacy for Environmental Justice. I run the Bay Youth for the Environment program for LEDGE. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about how LEDGE got involved with Candlestick, some of the active programming that we're doing at Candlestick, some restoration projects that we are embarking upon out there, and different ways that people can get involved in the park today. So basically, LEDGE, Literacy for Environmental Justice, has been around for about, we're going on 10 years. We're a Bayview Hunters Point nonprofit that serves primarily youth in Bayview Hunters Point and works with Bayview Hunters Point schools and runs job programs for local youth, engaging them in learning the principles of environmental justice, learning about sustainability, getting an opportunity to do something positive in their community, get their hands dirty, and also learn some leadership skills and life skills that will help them, you know, grow up and live good lives. Let's see, so we got involved, LEDGE actually got involved with Candlestick about 5 years ago. We were part of an environmental justice coalition that had Arc Ecology, Bayview Advocates, the Golden Gate Audubon Society, the University of San Francisco, and Clean Water Action as this group that was interested in studying an area called Yosemite Slough, which is a watershed here in San Francisco, and specifically looking at the catch basin of that watershed, Yosemite Slough, at Candlestick. So LEDGE got 20 youth from the community together, and in partnership specifically with Golden Gate Audubon and with the University of San Francisco, we went out and did a year-long baseline study of the wildlife that exist at Candlestick, and also some of the water quality issues that were happening at the bay. And to our surprise, we found really a high level of diversity out there. At the end of our census, we found over 130 species of birds, three species of snakes, rabbits, we saw fox, we saw skunk, we saw I think like 10 or 11 species of butterflies and a pretty substantial high amount of diversity for urban park. We also did a lot of water quality studying where we actually went into Yosemite Slough in waders, tested the water, found out what was going on there, and got kind of like a baseline assessment of the water quality for that area. So that's how we got involved. Shortly after the project ended, the California State Park Foundation approached Ledge and said, well, we have this need to fill a void in some of the public programming that's happening at Candlestick. And would you be interested? At that time, they were just getting started on embarking on fulfilling the general plans. You know, when Claude mentioned the general plan at Candlestick, one of the general plan, big components of it was a restored Yosemite Slough. So they did a feasibility study and wanted to do a wetland restoration project there. They thought it was going to, you know, cost them a few million dollars to do. And they said, hey, could you guys come in and potentially grow us native plants for the project? So we said, sure. So that's how we got involved. And we built a native plant nursery at the Candlestick Community Garden, which was pretty an exciting project. The community garden was opened in the 80s, probably like 1983, 84, and was a beautiful resource, but had been kind of neglected for several years. And off Carroll Avenue. And it had kind of fallen into a state of disrepair. So we got in there, cleaned up the place, built a nursery, got the program going. Right now we've got 10 youth in the program, and the Bay Youth Program solely exists to provide stewardship, advocacy, and experiences for young folks from Bayview, the opportunity to connect with nature. And this is actually us at the Marin Headlands on a trip a couple weeks ago. And as a part of connecting to nature, we do it every weekend at the park, but we also try to get out and see other things and bring youth to other places. So that's kind of like Bay Youth. One of the big things that we do is we work with a lot of volunteers out there. Since we started about 3 years ago, we've worked with about 2,000 volunteers who have helped us propagate over 15,000 native plants for the restoration of the park and other southeast shoreline parks like Heronset Park. We've taken a community garden. This is the community garden 3 years ago, and this is what it looks like today. And that's our nifty little native plant nursery. And some of the other things that we've done to kind of improve the area is we built, this is 3 years ago when we started, this is our old greenhouse in the back. We built a native demo garden so people could see what kind of plants we would be using for restoration projects, see the plants that they're actually propagating, because they look very different as seedlings as they do when they're full grown. And just to improve the quality of this resource. One thing that's really exciting is when we got into the community garden, I'd say about a third of the garden boxes were even usable. We now have 48 boxes that people can rent and use for the whopping total of $10 a year. So it's a really good deal, and it's a beloved resource at the community. One other thing that's really cool too, we're the only state park of the 280 parks that has a community garden. And it's one of our unique features, and it's kind of our home base for the Bay Youth Program. This we just did in the last few months. We now have a modern greenhouse, which is going to be aiding us in the propagation and restoration of the park for years to come. And all of these projects were done with the Bay Youth, which is, you know, a bunch of kids in high school, and hundreds of volunteers and school groups. So it's been kind of an empowering process One of the other things that's been really exciting, I think Claude might have alluded to this, when the park got going, there was a lot of staff, there was a lot of support for the park, and the state generally had more money. And over the years, the staff at Candlestick is about a third of what it was when it opened. So basically, the rangers there have been kind of relegated to opening the gates, closing the gates, you know, really unable to do a lot of the pioneering programming that was envisioned when the park was open. So Ledge has kind of tried to step in and fill that void. And what we've really been focusing on is the stewardship and the advocacy of the park. One of the major things that we've been doing over the last few years is Ledge has become the county coordinator of Coastal Cleanup Day in San Francisco. And when we got involved 3 or 4 years ago, there was one or two projects that actually cleaned up along the bay. This last year, I think the first year that we did it, we had about 100 volunteers on the east side of town, and with about 2,000 volunteers involved in the event. This year we got about 900 people out and literally pulled 15,000 pounds of trash from Candlestick. And these are the areas that are the areas that have primarily yet to be developed. The developed part of the parks are really, really clean. But as Claude had mentioned, about a fourth of the park has been developed. And at Yosemite Slough, we pulled out about 10,000 pounds of trash. So pretty crazy. So that's one of the things that we've also been really happy to do, is just increase people's awareness that the bay is an important resource in San Francisco. Candlestick is one of the few places where you can really access it, and really is a place that needs some stewardship. This is the recreation area. I don't know if everyone's familiar with it. Let's see, this is actually the developed portions of the park down here, and the areas of the park that are easy to visit and park, and there's trails and exercise stations. Basically from here all the way up into here and around the slough are areas of the park that are state land, but have never been redeveloped or have never been developed into parklands. In fact, this big area right here is a big gravel parking lot along with this area right here now, which is used for 49er parking and tailgating. So I'm pretty sure that wasn't the general plan's idea. And I wish I had the general plan with me, but I can kind of go over and jump in if I'm wrong about things. But I believe that this area was actually to be rolling hills. There was going to be a campsite where community members and youth could actually have the opportunity to camp in San Francisco. We only have one campground in San Francisco in the Presidio, and it would be great to have another one. Up here is Yosemite Slough, and the idea for this area was to actually restore it into tidal wetlands and have trails. It just seems to be jumping forward on its own. Oh, I see. So there's a lot of things that were envisioned in the park. There was an idea of having over here where the ranger station is at the top corner in the community gardens, there was an idea of having a nature center there. And in the Rock City area, I'm not exactly sure what the plan was, but this area right here is what we refer to as Rock City. And I have some pictures of that. And there is actually some restoration work that is happening this year out there, and we're really excited about that. So this is the main pier at Candlestick. You can just see that it's a beautiful way to just kind of feel that you're part of the bay and actually get out there and experience it. And during high tides, this thing is just tons of fishermen on a daily basis. It's a really popular location. Also, this area of the bay out here, it's one of the few places where people can windsurf in great numbers. So you have a very large windsurfing community that uses the park, and it's, you know, they can get 50 people out there windsurfing in one area and not run into each other. So it's really a special resource for them. This is the Rock City area, and I think Alan showed some photos of that, but you know, you can see that I think formerly it was a concrete dump, and areas of it have been kind of transformed into art, and there's that cool entrance, kind of has a Stonehenge feeling. Right now, State Parks is actually in the process of doing some debris removal out there because there was a fire out there recently, and a fireman broke his ankle trying to put the fire out. And so a little bit of money has been come available to do some rebar removal and get some of this nasty stuff out that could impale somebody, take out some of the rocks that are really, really dangerous. But we've been working really closely with State Parks and with the California Integrated Waste Management Board, who's the funder of the project. And what we're looking to do is leave some of this concrete in place and leave some areas of it that are a little bit more designed and a little bit more safe. So some of the high diversity of species that live out there, like the alligator lizards and the gopher snakes, and the rabbits still get this great cover that they rely on. The interesting thing enough, and you could speak to this too, is that when we did our wildlife census out there, this was one of the hotbeds of diversity. And you look at it, and it's a nightmare. It's a total wreck from like a visual standpoint. But the unique structures, all the little nooks and crannies, just provide so many places where things can hide. And we're finding things out there that we don't find anywhere else in San Francisco. And, you know, it's my hope that the redevelopment that comes in doesn't look at this as an area to just, you know, flatten and make it a big meadow and call it a park. But you know, really look to preserve some of the unique biodiversity that exists there.
Way back when we were running through the first plans of the park, it was decided to, there was a debate about this area, and it was decided, other than that, the fact that it was good habitat, it was also thought to be interesting in terms of it being a nice representative of what was there before it was developed, to say this is what our park used to look like. And so for that reason, it was also sort of left as is. And as someone who's tromped through there a number of times, one of the last times I was there, I don't know, a few months ago, I was looking for a burrowing owl or something, and had an 8-foot square piece of concrete. I stood on it, and all of a sudden it went like this, and I went down, and then it followed me down the hill. Unfortunately, it didn't land on me. But it's a really dangerous spot. So I kind of love it, but it's just really frighteningly dangerous. So it really has to have something done with it. But it's also a great resource.
Yeah, so we're hoping that what happens out there is a good thing. And we're looking at, you know, potentially, you know, using the riprap that's there that's usable to actually take care of some of the shoreline erosion that's happening at a really quick rate at different parts of the park. And then different areas of it, they're hopefully going to actually bury these piles and leave little areas of it exposed, like rock outcrops. And then the idea is that things will still be able to use the underground structure, and there won't be a massive disturbance on a big scale, but that unique labyrinth of habitat will still exist. And this winter, in the area just outside of Rock City, we're going to be planting about 3,000 to 5,000 native plants. We're going to be working with Tree Frog Treks to actually do some capture and release of some of the reptiles and snakes that we're worried about that could potentially be affected by the project. and introduce them to other areas of the park that we know that aren't, you know, getting developed. And then in March, they're going to go in and kind of do the earth moving and the heavy duty projects, bring clean fill in from condo developments on Bayview Hill. So it's staying in the neighborhood. And then we're going to hydro seed it with a bunch of natives. And then the next winter, I'm growing another 10,000 plants to go in and revegetate different areas. And our hope is to really, this is one of the few areas of the park that is really wild, that is really, you know, something else. And it is my intention to really get as many people involved to try to preserve it. So as more and more redevelopment happens in the area, there is sort of a large, massive area. This is about 13 acres in size that has the interior habitat and isn't just all edge and isn't, you know, just borders and little bands of park along the shoreline, but what will hopefully preserve some of this unique diversity here in San Francisco. So the other really big, exciting thing that's happening out there is the Yosemite Slough Wetland Restoration Project. So when the general plan was included, the community really wanted to clean up Yosemite Slough, restore the wetlands, create a nature-oriented park there, provide trails, and put an interpretive center in. And when they did, this is Yosemite Slough's aerial photo, and when state parks did their feasibility study with funding from the California State Park Foundation, California State Park Foundation is actually the lead on this project. It's not coming from state parks. They determined that it is possible to turn these upland areas into tidal marshes. And when the project is done, if it is completed in its full entirety, it'll be the largest contiguous wetland in San Francisco County. So we're really, really excited about it. When they were looking at doing this project, it looked like a $6 or $7 million project. But after they went in and did the soil test, did the plans, and got their 50% drawings done, that $6 million project went to a $27 million project. Largely because I believe this field here and this field here were former auto salvage dumps. And, you know, they're heavily impacted with heavy metals, PCBs, a lot of really nasty stuff. So to State Park Foundation's credit is they didn't say, oh my God, you know, this is too expensive. This is the biggest project State Parks Foundation's have ever taken on. This is an urban park. How are we gonna get funding for this? They've stayed the course, and to date they've raised $9 million. They're in the process of getting another $5 million this year, and if they get that $5 million from the Department of Public Recreation at the state level, they should be actually able to start construction in about 18 months. And the first phase of the project is going to be on this side of the slough right here. So this is the project boundary, basically. And, you know, just to also, this is what is left of a huge creek that went all the way up into McLaren Park. And historically, this whole area down here was open bay and tidal wetlands. And this little wetland here is what is left. And it's an area of extremely high diversity of wildlife. So you know, the project boundaries for the project, this is what it looks like from on top. This is where our community garden is, just to show you guys. And it's about 40 acres in size. This is what it will look like after restoration. So you have these big tidal embayments here. So these will have coastal salt marsh habitat on both sides right here. You'll have this beautiful bay trail going all the way around, connecting to the San Francisco Bay Trail. They've actually got these, the newer plans actually have some really cool decks in different areas where people can kind of come out and bird watch and get really close to the water without impacting the vegetation. One of the really cool things that they put in here is that they realized that Double Rock is a really unique nesting resource, and they've actually put two islands in. This island down here will be a devegetated island, so it'll be kind of bare and rocky, and would, you know, support sandpipers and, you know, ground nesting birds. This island here is actually probably going to have things like coyote bush on it, and it would be more of like things that egrets might want to roost on. And, you know, this will just be an amazing resource. The other idea is to put this interpretive center down here. And what I think is really exciting about this, when Claude was talking about this vision, this was a vision from you know, decades ago, and it's finally starting to happen. So we're really excited to be a part of that. This is what Yosemite Slough looks like today. You know, you can see that there's a lot of debris, you know, things need to get cleaned out. But, you know, still, when we think about our tidal wetlands in San Francisco, this is one of the few ones that we have. Yes, and we've been doing cleanups there for the last few years, which has helped a little bit. Another thing that we do is we get youth and younger people involved in advocating for the park. So this year, one of the big threats was the park was going to be closed. I think it was 48 state parks were on the list for closure. Candlestick was one of them. And we all went up to Sacramento on Park Advocacy Day, and we had more people than any other park. And we were more visible and more vocal and organized. And it was really an inspiring moment to see the new history of the park and the new stewards of the park. So that was a pretty exciting thing to be a part of. So what can you do? So as Claude mentioned, you know, there is an effort to get the Friends of Candlestick Park active again. We really think things are going to start ramping up in January, and we are looking for as many people to be involved as possible. And a couple other ways that people can get involved is you can volunteer with Ledge. A couple things that we have coming up in the horizon is we've got a massive winter planting out there. I think it's the first time any major planting has happened at Candlestick in 10 years. And we're really excited to have created a resource that can sustain the park for years to come and involve people actively in the restoration and stewardship of the park. One other thing that's really exciting is we have a new program that is actually launching now, and starting in January and February, we'll be doing sit-downs with community groups and individuals to try to get their inputs in what the redevelopment of this area, Candlestick and the Hunters Point Shipyard, should look like. And our plan is to get as much public input as possible, and then when we go to redevelopment, and when the ERI is in the planning process, we hope to just flood it with all these different ideas that people have for this area, and really try to think outside of what, you know, the city's vision for the area is, and really think again, you know, what the community wants, what people want out of their parks, and what we want of our shoreline. So that's my presentation.
Well, I just find this horribly inspiring, I have to admit. I love the fact that Candlestick Park has such intense, or Candlestick Point, I guess is a better way to put it, but such intense engagement from so many different people. I mean, I have a quick question for you, but either of you can answer this, probably having to do with the Superfund sites. I know that that was one of the issues around Yosemite Slough for a long time. Like, just at the end of it, there's a couple of spots that I believe are official federal designated Superfund sites. And I know there's been a great deal of toxic waste leaching into that area for a long time, and you spoke to that a little bit. But, you know, the Superfund law specifies that the people responsible are supposed to pay to clean it up. And, of course, we know that's not worked out that way for the most part. But I wonder if there's any funding available on a federal level for some of this work.
You know, actually, there is a little bit of funding that might be available by the EPA to clean up the slough itself. So the interesting thing about this $27 million project that the foundation is doing, which is largely a remediation project, not a wetland restoration project. Really, when you think about it, it's about making this land safe. And what's interesting is the actual water, where it says project boundaries there, that's actually a city jurisdiction, and it's not state jurisdiction. So the state can't clean that up. They don't have the money to do it. And presently, the people who are working on this project are working with EPA to look at some ways to kind of do a combined cleanup of both the uplands, upland landfills, and potentially the slough itself. How they would do that, I'm really unsure, but there has been some talk about that. And this actually is that little line right there, that is the beginning of the Hunters Point Shipyard and Parcel E. So the shipyard is right there. One of the other things, though, that we're finding out, this is a catch basin for a large watershed. And if you go into the community here, there's warehouse after warehouse after warehouse. And, whoops.
Just say deny. You can get it down there.
Okay, there we go. We think a lot of the pollution is coming from the street runoff, from a lot of the businesses in the area. You also have three sewer outflows there. You have a sewer outflow here, sewer outflow here, and a sewer outflow here. So during storm events, the PUC is permitted to allow raw sewage enter the bay there. And I know from when we were doing the water quality census and having actually been in waders collecting, you know, samples of that and bringing them back to the laboratories at USF, we did find on certain days, you know, elevated levels of fecal coliform. And PUC said it was from the birds. So there you go.
The birds.
Yeah.
Now, state PUC or
San Francisco PUC?
San Francisco PUC. Well, they don't have any experts on their three-person politically appointed panel.
Yeah.
Thank you. In other words, they don't know shit.
Don't you want to say that on the microphone, Lorella?
Is everybody here? In other words, they don't know shit. Okay.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that question, Chris, about the remediation. And it occurs to me it's interesting to think about the analogy between Candlestick and Crissy Field, which cost was on a similar order of magnitude. It was about $35 million, I think, for the whole entire 100-acre Crissy Field project, a large part of which was remediation. So, you know, it would be a shame to not be able to do essentially the same thing here that happened at Crissy Field. I have a few comments, but I wanted to maybe pass it off to somebody else before I get to that. And but a couple of questions, one for Alan and one for Patrick. Patrick, could we get your data that you all collected from the surveys?
You know, it's actually online, and I don't have the website link, but it was published by LSA and Golden Gate Audubon, and the water quality report was published too. So I think it's archived on Arc Ecology's website and Golden Gate Audubon's website, and if you can't find it there, I can track it down for you.
Okay, great. And Alan, it struck me when you were showing some of the specific species, the bird species, like the long-billed curlew and what's the one with the funky beak?
Oyster catcher,
yeah, that's also on Alcatraz. And the numbers that you cited worldwide, just I can't believe they're not federally listed. Could you talk a little bit more about that and just delve into that a bit?
The oyster catcher lives along the coast, and just in the last, 10 years, they've moved into the bay. And so their entire population is I think it goes up to Alaska and goes down to Southern California, and it just, it's in that very narrow band. And because they like rocky outcroppings, mostly right along the shore and offshore, they don't really have any threat. So their population may actually be increasing. So although they've got a really small population, it's not, doesn't look like it's threatened by anything. The long-billed curlew is a different issue. Their population is threatened mostly by development of wetlands in their nesting grounds. They nest in freshwater marshes and meadows and things like that to the north of us. And, of course, those get turned into farmland and all sorts of developments and things like that. So I haven't heard any pushes to make the curlew on a list, but then, you know, with the current administration, they haven't been, you know, trying to get things off the list as fast as possible and not put anything on. So
who else has something? Here we go.
What kind of fox did you see?
It was the red fox.
Oh.
Not the gray fox.
Okay.
But, you know, still pretty cool.
Yeah. And also, when you said it was a cement or concrete dump, you meant like it's, they were filling in the bay, right?
Well, I think actually it was, when you look at the dump, it's more than just fill. And there's actually a few other dumps like it. There's one on the port backlands, kind of back between Pier 94 and Pier 98, which is Heron's Head Park now. And I think it was, the intention was, is they bring all this old rubble, old streets, and pieces of just huge, you know, streets and buildings and that type of stuff. And they recycle it or turn it into riprap. And it's really unclear, because when you walk around the site, it's all just concrete. And it's not like, you know, if their intention was to fill, they would have just kept throwing it into the bay. And when you go there, it's just like peak and valley and peak and valley of these like rubble piles. And so I believe it was just specifically to deal with construction waste and streets and rubble and that kind of stuff.
Back in the old days, there were piles of telephone poles out there. I don't know if you noticed in the picture of the Newgate, the 1986 picture, but there was a big tall sculpture way off in the background that was made out of old telephone poles, and there were big piles of telephone poles out there and other things that were just sort of dumped out there for the time being. And at some point it all burned, and so then it was sort of turned into a park shortly thereafter.
Back on the subject of concrete for a minute, it does not soak in any of the rainwater. It lets it drain off and it goes into this already polluted water and becomes unusable as potable water or for wildlife either, for us or them. And right now they're digging up lots of median strips along the city streets and installing plants, which is great because we're clearing the earth again, and the water, rainwater will be used, it will become underground water. But what are they doing with that concrete? Is it going out there too? Does anybody know?
I think nowadays, I've seen like a lot of the like the Valencia Gardens when it was built. With new projects, what they do is they bring the concrete in, they pulverize it into angular pieces, and then they use it as new aggregate to build new concrete. So I think that concrete, for the most part nowadays, is hopefully recycled. I think the Port of San Francisco is going to be operating a concrete recycling facility in the port backlands. But you know, back in the day, it just went into the dumps. Or into the bay, yeah, as fill.
Anybody up here?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a couple comments and again draw a parallel between this area and Alcatraz, which occurred to me when we were meeting here the other day before the presentation, and the area that you all were highlighting in terms of having the highest wildlife diversity that you call Rock City. It to me seems like Alcatraz in the sense of a wild place where actually people have not been for quite a while. When Alcatraz closed as a prison many decades ago, there were no more people on the island, and so it sort of reverted back to being what it was, which was a habitat for seabirds. And the Park Service, of course, has done a great job of maintaining that habitat, the Natural Resource Division. So there's hundreds and hundreds of western gulls and cormorants which nest on Alcatraz every year. And so it's, you know, an analogous thing is happening there at Rock City with these wonderful species that you don't find in other places, such as the burrowing owls. And that then also made me think of just the broader issue of nature in the city. And, you know, what we're trying to do is create a real kind of inclusive vision of nature in San Francisco. We have our kind of richest native habitats, which are really rich botanically and for wildlife, of course, as well. In places like the Presidio and Twin Peaks and Bayview Hill, all the way down to these, you know, areas that to the untrained eye look derelict with pampas grass and everything else, but as we see, still have these great habitats, values. And the question that I often get is, well, what period do you restore to, you know, when we talk about restoring habitat and doing ecological restoration? And my answer now is, we restore to now. You know, we've screwed things up pretty badly, and we have some good places left. We have some interesting and sort of weird places left, but, you know, we've got to do it in a way that makes sense and that we decide on as a community and is good for the critters that are still there. So just wanted to make that pitch.
Can I comment? Sure. One of the things that excites me about doing restoration and visiting places like Candlestick and like Heron's Head and Alcatraz is that it shows that we can sort of coexist with wildlife, and it's an aesthetic and cultural decision that we make just as much as building a park of some other kind with a football field. And to me, it's really exciting to go out there and see that, okay, this was a landfill, and look what's out here now. You know, it's like we're constantly being told it's not pristine, it can't, you know, you can't do anything with it because it's not pristine, but, you know, the animals, the wildlife, the plants tell us otherwise, and I think it's pretty inspirational.
I think maybe part of the problem is the word restoration, because it implies going backwards to something. And actually, what all of you have spoken to really eloquently is how much we're making a conscious choice to make something somewhat new based on the resources at hand, and then augmenting and enhancing it as best we can as dumb humans in the face of the awesomeness of nature. How much better can we make it? We don't know.
Well, another thing is that as a teacher of kids and it's so important. Kids are so worried right now about the future of the earth. They're so scared. People who don't have any environmental influence in their lives, you know, they think that they're just scared the world's coming to an end. And so it's so nice to, for me, I don't emphasize the global warming anymore when I work with kids. You know, I don't emphasize the pollution, they know about that. I really emphasize like Heron's Head Park and the idea of restoration, that we can clean this up. You know, we can clean up our mess, and just to give them hope, because even if you know, the world freezes tomorrow, I'd rather like have it freeze with us having some hope rather than all biting our nails under a table.
Is Ledge still doing tours to Heron's Head Park?
Oh yeah, we still run that's how actually I got my start with Ledge, was with the Heron's Head Park programs. And we still do tours of the park, so school groups, community groups that wanna come up and come out and get a guided tour, put on the boots, get in the mud flat, you know, test the water, do some bird watching, you know, we offer that free to the public. And I actually have some flyers back there that will let people know how to get involved in that.
Do you want to speak to your planting day? Do you know?
Actually, a couple things. I forgot to mention the areas of the park that are potentially going to get swapped and some of the development threats. So I'll talk about that in just one quick second. But every first Saturday from 10 to 1, I run a volunteer day where people can drop in and we propagate native plants for restoration projects. Following that, we do a nice barbecue, which is potluck. So people are welcome to do that. And we do a similar day at Heron's Head on the second Saturday. And that's every month. And then if people have groups or schools that want to come out and do it by appointment, we're more than happy to set that up. But I know there was some questions about... Yeah, some of the things that we're worried about, and you can't see this on the map, this is where the Hunters Point Shipyard is, and some of this reconfiguration is that they would take a huge chunk of the state park here, which was actually envisioned to be swells and berms and campgrounds and open space, and swap it for parts of the Hunters Point Shipyard. And ever since the Hunters Point Shipyard community process has been going on, there was always an idea of having open space along the southern part of the Hunters Point Shipyard and restoring that area. So I feel that by swapping the land, we actually lose an opportunity to have more parkland in the city. And instead of what we end up with a park, you can already see this is kind of a long, skinny band of vegetation that goes along the bay. And what we don't want to end up with is this really, really narrow band of habitat that has no depth and has no space for critters and wildlife to hide and find refuge. We don't want just like a bay trail as our park. We want an area where you can kind of walk into the park, get lost, you know, feel like you're in a natural area, forget about the fact that you're in the city, and kind of a places that will support things like burrowing owls and jackrabbits that live out there and meadowlarks that like open spaces. I've found a very few garter snakes. I've found ringneck snakes and a lot of gopher snakes.
Isn't there one proposal suggesting a connector to the 101 right
through the... I'll kind of walk through it. I wish I would have... So Lennar's proposal right now actually has 101 and having a big through there right through here that connects over here. And in their plan presently, they actually have a bridge going across Yosemite Slough where we're doing this multi-million-dollar wetland restoration project. And it's mostly being fueled by the needs of the 49ers. 49ers want to move this stadium. Actually, it's unclear where the 49ers want to. But the city wants to move them into the Hunters Point Shipyard. And the city really doesn't want to lose the 49ers because of the political embarrassment. And if they put this bridge here, we feel that it totally is looking at the state park as the path of least resistance. It's totally bisects this natural experience. It totally throws the community's vision to the wind. And it's largely being pushed forward by the political legacy of the current mayor and the idea that the 49ers are the most important thing for the Bayview Hunters Point community. And, you know, it's funny. I went out there the other day. Before the game is the only time that the city really goes out there and cleans up the community. And then after the game, you got like three or four people walking around this huge parking lot with trash pickers, thousands of seagulls eating trash. And it takes them like a week or two to clean up. And, you know, they put their effort into cleaning up before the game. So when people come and spend $200 or $300 in the Bayview, they don't, you know, see the tires and the TVs and the mattresses and you know, the cleanest I've ever seen the streets are the morning of the game. And it's kind of shocking. So a couple other things that are in the plan. They want to build housing in this area right here, high density housing. They're talking about 30,000 new units between this parking lot and the Hunters Point Shipyard. And another big fear that we have is, you know, you're going to have all these new people wanting to use the park, and it's going to actually increase the pressure on the park. And you have redevelopment really looking at this park not as a natural area, not as a state resource, but kind of as, you know, this place where people can jog and walk their dogs and enjoy their million-dollar views and their condos. And that's very troubling. Yeah, right next to a Superfund cleanup site. On the other hand, there are some opportunities to complete the park. There are some opportunities to get more cleanup money for the Hunters Point Shipyard and for this area. So, you know, it's not all entirely bad. I just think that it's the process that's driving it seems to be a process that's not, you know, in tune with the community. The other thing that we're afraid of too is all this development that they want to do out here kind of turns their back on Third Street and turns the back on the community that lives there and kind of creates this like little shopping plazas and high rises and almost in a sense a gated community. And we also feel that this bridge would enable people to come into Bayview and not have to deal with Third Street, not have to deal with the actual residents, come in, spend their money at the game, and then leave. And not come in and not spend any money. And one of the things that's true with all state parks is for every dollar that the state spends on a state park, it generates $3 or $4 into the general fund through like taxes and revenue for the state. So the state park is a moneymaker for the community. And, you know, people are buying food, they're buying beer, they're buying fishing poles, they're buying, you know, binoculars, all that kind of stuff to use the park and spending money in the local economy. And what we don't want is something that totally turns its back on Bayview. So all these things are going to get, you know, potentially figured out over the next couple of years. And we really urge people to stay up on them and really get engaged. And we really look forward to getting the new Friends of group established and really trying to make sure that the big battle and the big fight that went in to reclaiming the shoreline isn't lost. You know, presently there's a bunch of environmental groups that have been talking to the mayor's office and trying to outline environmental principles that we feel that should be included in the redevelopment process. And so there is a small bit of opposition. There was also opposition to Prop G from the environmental community. And the environmental community in San Francisco also supported Prop F, I think it was Prop F, which was the countermeasure to Prop G. But Prop G overwhelmingly passed, so this is what we're facing.
So
but
I just,
there needs to be more, for sure.
Sorry. Yeah, I just wanted to validate your expressions on the concerns here, Patrick, and express appreciation for you being so frank about what the problems are there, because I know, you know, in some ways it's sensitive for you and for Ledge with your relationship with the state parks and everything and how it relates to how the development is going to unfold and, you know, who's going to benefit from the swap or whatever. So as I said earlier, you know, Nature in the City is in total solidarity with everybody who's working on this problem in that community, and we are part of that kind of currently ad hoc coalition, and hopefully we can create a lot more strength among the environmental community working with the larger community there as well, and we'll see how that unfolds. Do we have any other comments or questions, gripes or criticisms?
You mentioned you were growing native plants for mm-hmm. you were propagating. Is there a charge for these if somebody's got a community activity going on?
We're looking to expand to do public sales. Right now, we're funded to grow for the state parks, and we do a little bit of propagation for Heronshead Park as well. But presently, we're kind of like a for public lands nursery. But I'm hoping that we get an opportunity to like at least provide a few thousand plants annually so people can put them in their backyard, put them in their school gardens, you know, provide them for things like the Native Plant Society. So right now, though, we don't sell to the public, but some fall off the truck now and then.
I was just going to mention that tomorrow is the Native Plant Society's annual sale. Mm. Is it next week?
Yes.
Okay, it's the 6th, Thursday the 6th.
I was going to bring up sort of in conclusion, and I want to thank you both for a great evening, amazing information, and really well presented. I want to say that we have two more talks on this current calendar, and we have many more planned right behind that. But coming up in 2 weeks, on the 12th of November, we have the best local historian, Gray Brecken, is going to be here doing a slideshow on the indispensable legacy of the New Deal. And it's interesting to think about this whole issue of how this place is going to unfold, all these development plans and whatnot, and the extent to which the voice of the public interest, is really often left out. And these things are driven by the private and pecuniary interests of people like Gavin Newsom and the 49ers. Whereas we really need to have a public interest expressed, and that's what the interesting legacy of the New Deal is how much of our existing infrastructure still dates from that period of time when we were doing things for some sort of self-declared public interest. And all of us probably have fond fantasies that we might be on the verge of that again, but who knows? We can't really be too confident with people who call themselves Democrats. But anyhow, be that as it may, the other talk that's coming up in about 3 weeks on the 19th of November is the next Nature in the City talk, which is Greening San Francisco one street at a time. And we have three panelists who are all totally involved in that process. So turn out for the next two talks on the 12th and the 19th of November, and we will continue many of these conversations in other specific ways, but very much in the same meta level of what we've been discussing tonight. So thank you all for coming, and thank you so much for presenting. And it will also be online as a podcast for anybody who's interested. We usually get it up a day or two afterwards, so you can go back to the calendar on the CounterPulse site and find the link directly to the podcast. Any last thoughts? Nope? Okay.
Thank you.
Lorilla.